For the week of February 26th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 138, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich. Michael, that's your cue to...
Oh, I'm sorry. I was doing my tribute to the Oscar winner silent film, The Artist.
Oh, The Artist. Well, I mean, yeah, it was kind of a big weekend here in Los Angeles and really for the film world in general. I mean, let's face it, everybody is talking about the big award and awards over the weekend, the Publicist Guild Awards, which were held. I believe they were here in Hollywood. I didn't actually attend them, but...
How... It's the Publicist Award?
Yeah, isn't that what everybody's talking about? I mean...
That's very funny. I've never heard of it, and that's sort of funny in and of itself, isn't it?
Yeah, the Publicist Guild has a union. Well,
Publicist
Guild is a union.
But why they would choose to do it the weekend of the Oscars is beyond me. But I never even heard of the awards. They're not doing a good job publicizing it.
Well, they held them, I think, on Friday, and The Help won. But
that's not really the big award this weekend.
No. Of course, it was the Spirit Awards was the big award this weekend.
That's not the big award either.
What else was... Oh, you mean the Academy Awards. The one handed out by the college down the...
What?
Academy. I thought, I could play off of a cat. Hey, my jokes are as good as Billy Crystal's. What do you know?
Yeah, really.
Well, you know, on today's show, we will, of course, be talking about the Oscars. We'll be joined by Ann Thompson, an editor-at-large at IndieWire, where her blog, Thompson on Hollywood, can be found. She's also the co-creator of Oscar Talk, a podcast that you can download probably definitely off of iTunes. And, of course... she'll be here to talk about what else, the Oscars. We'll also talk about how Google is looking to become your new cable television provider. And speaking of which, Hollywood is really excited about all these new streaming services like Netflix, and we'll talk about a few others. And, you know, all these new services are licensing their content. We'll explain. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we'll turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who is going to fill us in on the weekend's box office, because that's where the big news comes in with Act of Valor.
Well, we'll get there. And number one worldwide is Journey to the Mysterious Island, the sequel to Journey to the Center of the Earth. It grossed another $32 million worldwide. It's at $236 million and counting, equaling the total take of the original. And of course, it's still number one around the world, so it's going to be making a lot more money.
You know, the irony is I'm trying to be ironic by saying that the big news is Act of Valor.
It is big news.
And the big news really is that Journey to the Mysterious Island, a sequel to a movie that was based on a book which did not have a sequel, is the number one movie around the world.
No, I think Act of Valor is very big news. Number two around the world is Safe House with Denzel Washington. Another $25 million. It's at $134 million and counting. At number three around the world is Act of Valor. It opened in North America only, where it's the number one film at the box office. It grossed $24 million. This is Hollywood's idea of a great, great film. It costs $12 million to make. Not only does it not have any stars, it barely has any actors, since most of the people in the film are actual members of the military. So, you know, it's doubled its budget in the first weekend. This is their idea of heaven.
Well, I mean, it had a huge advertising campaign. It had four spots during the Super Bowl. I mean, Relativity, really went all out on this. In fact, they were screening this film at every festival. They showed it at Blog World. Okay, that should tell you, you know, they really wanted this film to do well.
Well, don't they want every film to do well?
Well, yes, but they were going way out of their way for this film.
Well, it paid off. At number four around the world is This Means War, the Reese Witherspoon action comedy. It grossed $23 million. It's at $60 million and counting. And number five is a debut in North America, Tyler Perry's Good Deeds. It grossed $16 million, putting it at number two in North America and, of course, number five around the world. It will not open anywhere else. His films never open overseas. At number six is The Vow, the Channing Tatum, Rachel McAdams romantic drama. That grossed $14 million worldwide. It's at $133 million and counting. It's the first film by Screen Gems to ever gross more than $100 million in North America. Channing Tatum is their in-house superstar. They should just send flowers to his mother every week. At number seven is Nicolas Cage's film Ghost Rider, Spirit of Vengeance. I almost just called it a comedy. It grossed $11 million worldwide. It's at $43 million and counting. It's quite a bit of a disappointment. And number eight is Chronicle. It grossed $9 million worldwide. It's just under $100 million worldwide and counting. This is another very low-budget film, $12 million. It's the movie about teenagers with psychic powers, and it's Hollywood's idea of the future. At number nine is The Woman in Black, the Daniel Radcliffe Victorian thriller. It grossed $8 million worldwide. It's at $76 million and counting. And at number 10 is the reissue of Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. It grossed $8 million worldwide. It has $86 million and counting, which is pretty remarkable for a movie that even its fans don't think is very good.
And I think the whole franchise now, or is it that particular movie?
Particular movie, as we predicted last week, as we told you, would gross more than $1 billion, the first one in the series to do so.
Right.
And at number 11 is The Descendants, the George Clooney drama, which grossed another $7 million. It's at $156 million and counting, making it the second most successful, of all the Oscar-nominated films. And it still has a ways to go. And at number 12 and 13 are two disappointments in North America. Wanderlust is a romantic comedy starring Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. That grossed $6.6 million. It opened at number 8 in North America, way down on the list. And right behind that is Gone, a thriller starring Amanda Seyfried about a serial killer. That grossed $5 million.
Now, Wanderlust, how did that get reviewed? I mean, the couple reviews I read were positive reviews.
No, it did not get good reviews.
And they were saying, well, this is kind of a guilty pleasure. We should not like this movie, and it's not a great movie, but it was enjoyable. I mean, that was like not the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times said that.
Well, it's at 60% at Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, so not great. Good. Yeah, not great at all.
So it's a disappointment for Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. I like him a lot as well. She's not having a big success with this movie. She certainly has never come within 100 miles of the Oscars.
No, and just to clarify, you said Tyler Perry's movies don't open overseas. They open, they just don't do well.
I haven't seen them. I haven't seen them ever released overseas.
Oh, okay.
Well, I have no box office figures for any of his Madea films or anything. I'd be interested to know if they open even in Africa or, I don't see any record of them opening in Europe or Australia or anywhere. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but looking at the certain sites like The Numbers and Box Office Mojo and other stuff, I see no figures for any overseas, grosses at all. They don't bother to open them. They don't try. And if you look at The Help, that grossed $40 million overseas. So there's some money to be made.
Well, and you probably heard somebody laughing there. And that person is Ann Thompson, an editor at large at IndieWire, where her blog Thompson on Hollywood can be read. And Ann had a very quiet weekend at home this weekend. And so we thought, since she wasn't doing much, we'd ask her to join us to discuss something she may know a little about. We think she might be somewhat of an expert on the Oscars, especially. Yeah. I mean, your podcast Oscar Talk, I'd love to know what's going to happen with that now that the Oscars is over. But you had
we have to do our postmortem later today. Actually, Chris and I are going to do it in a couple of hours, and I'll have to admit that I owe him $20 for getting cinematography wrong.
Well, let's actually, I guess I was going to say, should we start with the Spirit Awards? But I guess maybe we can conclude.
Need to talk about the Spirit Awards.
The Spirit Awards were lovely because Michelle Williams got to win, and gave a really good speech. There was a little bit of drama because the artist gang was delayed, from Paris having won 6 Césars and were they going to show up? And Dujardin didn't make it, and Michelle Hazanavicius got there in the nick of time. So that was all sort of exciting. Otherwise, it was fairly dull.
Well, kind of like the Academy Awards. I thought, how could you really do any worse than James Franco and Anne Hathaway as hosts last year? And Billy Crystal did not do a bad job on the telecast last night. But
I thought it was better than last year.
Oh, absolutely. But it was also kind of boring.
Well, the whole thing with the artist is interesting. I mean, it's really too bad when this happens because it's true. When you get to the Oscar cast, you've seen all the speeches. Christopher Plummer has given that speech, his agent provocateur, he says it at every single speech, from the broadcast film critics to the Globes to the BAFTA, everything. And so, those of us especially who watch every single one, it does become awfully familiar but for those of us who actually do make predictions, there were a number of categories that were surprising. I mean, things like Dragon Tattoo getting best editing, for example, which may not seem earth-shattering, but
that was shocking. That was shocking. I don't know how that happened,
especially since it was the second time in a row that they had won.
Editors
had won. Now, out of all the categories, you got 19 correct. Christopher Plummer, you had selected for Best Supporting Actor. He won. Octavia Spencer, you had selected for her role in The Help. She won. But when it came to Best Actor and Best Actress, I mean,
I picked wrong.
These were the two toss-ups, in my opinion, for the.
They were toss-ups, and so it's okay. You know, it's not. I'm more upset. Those were very, very tight races. I'm more upset that I got cinematography and the two Hugo wins, cinematography and what was the other, the unexpected one?
Art direction and cinematography.
Yeah, no, that one I expected. Visual effects. Thank you. So those I had not expected to go to Hugo. So Hugo did really well. And I should have figured that it was going to be sort of sweeping the technicals in its own way. Yeah.
Let me ask you about that for a second before going back to actors and directors and Best Picture. Visual effects. I mean, so you picked Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and I would have picked Rise of the Planet of the Apes. What was it that made you say, okay, it's going to be Planet of the Apes over Hugo? Was it, you know, other guilds and unions had voted for on the run-up to the awards, or was it...
There was some of, I mean, it did okay but what happens with a lot of these guild awards like the VES is that you have all these different categories, you know, and it, sometimes it's hard to make, like with costumes or, you know, where they have periods separated from, you know, or even the art directors. I knew it would be Dante Ferretti, that I was clear about, but also Hugo was just such a bigger, more classy, much more, the scale and scope was, and the artistry of Hugo was, I should have recognized that was going to trump everything. But Rise of the Planet of the Apes had character animation in it. That's why it had this extraordinary performance capture. I talked to Joe Letteri on the red carpet. I mean, it really did break new ground and go, you know, further than, you know, I've been watching his career for a long time. This may be one of those cases where my knowledge was slightly, you know, gave me some insight into what went into that, movie that, and I wasn't biased by the fact that it was a genre film, whereas the whole Academy was voting for that. And so they just went for the most beautiful and the most, you know, splendid movie, if that makes any sense.
So you were on the red carpet, and I assume you were in the press room covering the show?
Yes, I was.
My condolences.
Was it a sleepy year? Was it a mellow year? What was sort of the atmosphere back?
Yeah, it was a mellow year. I didn't see the dictator, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen dumping ashes on Ryan Seacrest, you know, which was the sort of red carpet story. But for me, you know, having covered it so thoroughly and interviewed so many of the players, I got a big kick out of having Dolores Hart come over, the nun, in one of the shorts, who's an Academy member and hasn't been to the Oscars ever and hasn't, you know, been in Hollywood, you know, in front of the cameras since 1963. You know, it was just amazing to talk to her. And the, you know, the Pakistani director of Saving Face, which won the Oscar, you know, where they're actually changing the laws in Pakistan. You know, the movies, to talk to the Paradise Lost guys, you know, there was this guy who's been in jail for 18 years and he's studying to get into law school. I mean, these are real stories that had impact because of the movies that were made about them.
I think you're talking about Jason Fried, if I'm not mistaken, from Paradise Lost.
The Memphis Three.
Memphis Three. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, that is a kind of an incredible story because 7 months ago he was in prison on death row and now he's walking the red carpet at the Academy Awards. It's a pretty...
That's the stuff. And the guy who, from The Undefeated, the documentary, the coach who took on these kids on a football team, a very deprived, you know, football team, and actually helped them to win a championship and change their lives and give them opportunities they never would have had. I was getting sort of teary-eyed when I met this guy, you know? That's what movies do.
Right. And that's, I think, ties into the biggest storyline of the Oscars, which is we should rename it the Weinsteins. We've said this before, but their domination this year was unbelievable. Best Picture,
really was.
Best Actor, Best Actress for Meryl Streep for The Iron Lady. It took Harvey Weinstein in 30 years to get her one.
By making that the story. That's what Harvey did. He planted that seed and he wouldn't let go of it. He said, she's overdue, she's overdue, she's overdue. How can you ignore her? And that's why she won. It was that incessant hammering.
Well, also, somebody mentioned today, I read for the first time, that the DVDs for The Iron Lady did not go out till after the voting was over for the SAG Awards. So the SAG members did not have a chance, unless they went to the movie theater, to actually see The Iron Lady. So that could have influenced their voting for Viola Davis.
Well, Viola Davis gave her best shot, and I think she did a lovely job of being, you know, supremely intelligent and raising the bar, really, for what, you know, you can do in this kind of campaign to raise consciousness about African-American roles and the limitations of her world. And I was so convinced that she was going to win. I really was. I was more convinced of that win. I knew that I didn't know. Between Clooney and Dujardin. But I thought, I really did. And most of the predictors did too. But I think it's Harvey. I think he made that difference in that case.
I still can't explain how Dujardin won Best Actor. Not that he was bad. I mean, really, if it came down to George Clooney and Dujardin from The Artist. But Clooney gave it, you know, kind of a career performance in The Descendants. And
in a less popular movie, a movie that was truly divisive. I mean, you could talk to people. There's something about Alexander Payne's sensibility that rubs some people the wrong way. And the thing about George, who's so well-liked and so popular and everything, but he couldn't compete with The Artist. The Artist was just such a juggernaut. That carried Dujardin with it. In other words, if Clooney had been the star of The Artist, he would have won too. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Right. Well, okay. That's. I mean, really, that is kind of the story. There is that there was this wave of The Artist for the big awards, and in the beginning of the evening, they started giving out some of the craft awards like cinematography, which. You thought, as did I, as did most people, that Emmanuel Lubezki would win the award for Tree of Life. But in the end, it was Robert Richardson for Hugo, and then it was Hugo for sound editing and mixing. And
yeah, that I got. Yeah, no, but I knew it would win a lot of technicals. I just didn't realize how many. But that's there. You know, that's a very popular filmmaker, very revered, and they gave it. They went with the, and it was a very expensive movie, $170 million. It's remarkable The Artist did as well as it did, considering how little it cost. I mean, I think he shot in 35 days. He made that point backstage, Michelle Hazanavicius.
Well, and I guess I look at this and say, well, you know, people really do need to see your movie because the American Society of Cinematographers gave the award to Tree of Life and several other, you know, whether they were critics circles or, you know, awards being given out, they all went to Tree of Life because it is a beautiful film. But in the end, it went to Robert Richardson, who has already won two Academy Awards already.
But it was also for degree of difficulty. It was for the 3D, you know, it was for the sort of eye-popping artistic use of 3D. And also it was a period film and everything. So was Tree of Life, but it didn't have all the bells and whistles that Hugo did. Now, I learned a valuable lesson on this one.
What was the lesson?
Well, if you have a $170 million movie directed by Martin Scorsese that gets more nominations than anything else, it's going to win a few. That's the lesson.
And so, and you picked Hazanavicius for Best Director.
Oh, yeah.
And was there a reason? I guess it really came down to Scorsese and Hazanavicius.
Scorsese had won recently.
2006 The Departed. But now with Best Actress, Meryl Streep, I mean, as Michael, you mentioned, she hadn't won in 29 years. She's won two awards already. So was that the reasoning for going with Viola Davis in your picks, in your mind?
I thought that the story Viola Davis was telling was so moving and that she had just elevated that film to such a degree with that dignified performance. And I thought her story was resonating, perhaps more than it was. You know, Meryl, but it turns out that the Academy wanted to reward Meryl for all of her. I think also the idea was that this might be the last chance Meryl would have for some, you know, that she might not have that many great actress performances in her. I don't know why, because I think she does, but that there seemed to be some sense that time was running out and they needed to give her the award this time.
Yeah, you know, I had a side bet on standing ovations with a friend about which actors would get standing ovations, and all of them did except for Jean Dujardin, which I thought was interesting. I don't know what the mood was in the house, but I assume Clooney didn't stand, and therefore nobody else wanted to stand. If he'd stood up, I imagine they all would have stood up as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Clooney literally would have come to the opening of an envelope to promote this Oscar campaign. I mean, he was on everywhere.
They all were. I mean, Brad Pitt was everywhere, too. There was a real race there. There was a three-way race there. And it is possible that Brad and George knocked each other out, the two American movie stars, and Dujardin slipped through.
Oh, that's
true. This is the third time in history that someone has, fourth time, I should say, that someone has gotten an Oscar giving a non-English language performance. You know, three of them were in foreign languages, Roberto Benigni, Marion Cotillard, and Sophia Loren. And Jean, I guess, is the first guy in 80 years to win for a silent film performance. I imagine there have been a few in the first few years when The Wings won Best Picture. But basically, you know, he's a foreign actor who doesn't really speak English who won an Oscar. And that's only happened four times in history.
But he got away with it being in a foreign film because the Weinstein Company was so clever at presenting the movie as though it weren't foreign. Just as the movie itself doesn't reveal his language until the very end. And he used, it became an asset in the campaign because all the clever visual tools that they used, the Weinstein Co., all the little bits and the Saturday Night Live, Funny or Die, you know, he's singing the Marseillaise backstage at the SAG Awards. He made a silk purse out of a sow's ear the whole time. He doesn't speak English very well at all.
No,
yeah,
he doesn't.
And it was shot as the only film among the nominees to be shot completely in Los Angeles. I mean, they just made its connection to Hollywood so strong and clear.
That's
every step
did.
Of the way.
They even convinced the Indie Spirits that it was an American film, which
I couldn't believe
outrageous.
That.
Outrageous. And
yes.
That's what I was going to say earlier. In hindsight, I really do wish that the Indie Spirits had fought Harvey. They should have stood up to him and recognized, you know, that the artist really didn't belong there. It didn't. It was a French movie. It should have been in the foreign category. But their foreign category is strictly, is an international category. It doesn't have anything to do with language. It should have been there.
I was actually interviewed by a French journalist over the weekend as to what I thought about the Oscars and the fact that The Artist was nominated and how it was nominated as an American film and how is it that they made it an American film and why isn't it the press hasn't made a bigger deal of that? And part of my reasoning was, you know what, if you give that away, if you basically mention that it's French up front, you're giving away one of the you're giving away the ending, which is one of the nicest aspects of the film, is that little kind of reveal at the end.
Well, the guy, Seth Rogen, the host at the Indie Spirits, got a few laughs because he said, you know, he was basically saying, you know, why did you let the artist get away with this? You know, didn't Roberto Benigni teach us something? You know, if you got the foreigners in, you're doomed, you know. But because of its silence, it was able to be a truly global film. And I do applaud the artist for that. I think it's wonderful that they weren't limited by their language.
Well, now let me ask you this. Speaking of laughs, they brought back Billy Crystal for, you know, I guess his ninth time as the host of the Academy Awards. And I know when you're backstage, you can't really watch the awards as closely as you'd like because you're busy dealing with actors and winners who are appearing before you to be interviewed. But I mean, what did you think of the whole telecast? I don't know. I just felt like it was somewhat tired in a way or dated. The material was somewhat dated.
You know, I mean, it may be a generational thing. I'm fond of Billy Crystal. I laughed, you know, I thought he kept it going in a good way. I thought that they put, you know, Brian Grazer booked a lot of comedy presenters, you know, who did well. I thought the Emma Stone and Ben Stiller skit really worked. It was very funny. And I thought the Bridesmaids gang was terrific. You know, some of the video stuff worked for me. You know, I thought it was one of the better ones. And Cirque du Soleil was terrific.
God, really?
I thought so. If I'm the target, you know, they did well by me, but I understand a lot of other people would have, they tried, you know, with the presenters to keep it young and hip and groovy, but it obviously wasn't enough for you guys.
Oh, but it's a 3-hour show. I don't need to see a circus act. You know, at least why didn't they have Jason Segel and a Muppet doing their song?
Know. They should have had that too.
Yeah, but you don't need a circus act. And it's a 3-hour show. We don't need filler. With 35 minutes to go, we had three awards and they still ran over.
Well, I mean, you know what? Yeah. I'm going
to. Not so much, though. 7 minutes is a relatively short Oscar cast. They're very pleased with themselves.
Yes, that is true. And 40 million
and
people
had better ratings than the year before.
Right.
By a little bit. Yeah.
Yes. 40 million people watched it, up a little bit from last year. And the Cirque du Soleil thing was, in my opinion, and I'm not condoning it, I'm just saying that it was a bit of a political move because Cirque du Soleil is in the what is now the Kodak Theater.
It's called the Kodak Theater. It's a show that celebrates Hollywood, and they obviously did it because it's not doing very well, and they needed to promote the show. You know, that's why they did it. But I liked it.
Yeah, they kicked the show out of the Kodak Theater for a month. So
yeah, they owed it to them.
Yeah, it was kind of a political thing. But, you know, Michael, you consistently make the statement either to me personally or in your writing that, you know, you watch these award shows, specifically the Oscars, and you at the end of it, you have no idea what any of the movies are about.
Right. You could have watched the Oscars and have very little idea of what the best films, best performances are about. You know, finally, they showed us, they had the introduction to best actor and actress where they explained the role. And then they showed the clip. Well, that wasn't, you could have just shown the clip. You didn't need to have the introduction explaining what, how important their performance was. But in general, longer, more substantial clips from these movies, which are not that well known by people, would be a lot more involving than, you know, a comedy bit about test marketing The Wizard of Oz or
I didn't go for that one either. Or
a tired old montage of classic movie clips, which I thought was particularly rote this year. But
I didn't understand. Did he set that up? Why were we looking at that?
Because it was supposed to be about, you know,
the love of movies,
you know. Going to the movies. And, you know, really, you could get this sense that they were, the Academy Awards this year were trying to say, look, you know, windows are collapsing and you can watch movies on your iPhone. And, you know, but it's really about the magic of going to the movies. And we want to kind of highlight that and underscore that because they mentioned it again and again and again. And I guess they feel somewhat threatened. And you got that sense, at least I did, while watching it. Maybe I was just reading too much into it.
Well, I didn't think that they needed to bring Tom Sherrick out, but then Billy Crystal got his biggest laugh. So
that is true. That is Tom Sherrick being the president of the Academy. And, yeah. I mean, you know, I guess I was trying to think, Michael, of what, you know, we watch the Grammys and when it's over, we kind of say, wow, that was a lot of fun. And why is it a lot of fun?
Because it's performances.
Yeah, that's right. Live performances, but that's why they should show movie clips, substantial scene, gripping scenes. These are the best films of the year. Show us why.
Right. And I guess I was saying, well, what can you do? You can't show 10 minutes of a movie.
Most people who see the Oscars have not seen the films.
And I thought, well, maybe what you could do is, and they did this one year in Cannes, they showed 20 minutes of Gangs of New York. Now, I'm not saying you should show 20 minutes or even 10 minutes, but it would be interesting to show a kind of a highlight reel or a promo reel from a film of one of the best picture nominees to actually get that sense of, oh, that's what the movie's about.
They'd have to go back to five.
doesn't need to be 10 minutes long or two, just a clip, a substantial clip. They're called trailers. They do them all the time.
Now, Anne, you're saying you object to nine nominees?
I do. I still do.
Well, why?
I just don't think it makes – go back to five. Go back to what we all – you know, let them vote for five. Let there be five. And let's get over this business of trying to, you know, add more commercial movies to the list, which is what that's all about.
Well, I think on a stronger year with – more of a front runner that will happen. I think this year you saw that the reason there were nine movies was because there was no clear front runners to suck up a lot of the votes. And I think in most years you'll have
so
five or six movies
with one win, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting as you know, to your point, Michael, that, and to your point, Anne, about how stories are created through these Oscar campaigns in the Oscar season. Originally in December, there really was no front runner. And over time, a frontrunner kind of emerged, and it came down to The Artist versus Hugo. And I think that story was manufactured by these campaigns. Am I completely off base, Anne?
Well, there was a face-off in the end. The two films really were in contention because there were five wins for each one. One of them had 11 nominations and the other had 10. So that they were the two most popular of the group. I mean, if there was any third film, it would have to be Descendants, and it was a distant third.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, what was it like backstage? What was the feeling like backstage? I know sometimes when you're in that press room, you can kind of hear, you know, especially at the beginning when people are all focused on the telecast, you can kind of hear what other people are thinking of it, other journalists.
There was a big roar when the Dragon Tattoo won Best Editing. I mean, there was no question. That rippled through the room. That was like a shocker.
Oh, okay.
And then Meryl was fabulous backstage, and they ate that up. She was very articulate and charming, and she was also funny. She was sort of saying, "Can I leave now? I'm thirsty." You know, she wanted to get her glass of champagne. You know,
did she mention Viola Davis backstage?
Not backstage, no. I asked her on the carpet. I mean, she had been so supportive of Viola.
Yeah,
she kept saying she's my girl. You know,
when she actually. And it was announced that she won Meryl Streep and she got up on stage there. I've been in that room where, you know, Robert Redford has been speaking and I think it was Halle Berry won. And literally it was as if he wasn't even in the room anymore. People just gasped and he was kind of shocked and wondered what was going on. And then he saw Halle Berry on stage and went, oh, let's watch this. I mean, did any of those weird moments happen last night where somebody holding an award is answering questions and then all of a sudden nobody's paying attention to them?
I think the Iranian director, Farhadi, was there for quite a long time when there were some big awards being announced. But I couldn't, it's really fun because you're sitting there and you have to be terribly focused because you're writing and you're listening to the people coming in and you have a little headset and then you can either listen to the show or you can listen to the people coming in. You have to sort of decide.
Yes.
And then everybody's hammering away during the... Sometimes the people are talking during the commercials, too. I mean, the commercials are a break. You can actually work during that. So it's always a choice that you make, and you have a sort of weirdly fragmented view, you know, perception of the show. I mean, I really should sit down and look at it again.
I have done that, actually, after covering it, just because I wanted to see what it was like watching it from, you know...
beginning to end. So it may have been way more entertaining for me than it was for everybody sitting through the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I saw a number of television critics write that it started off slow and got really slow before it finally bored you to tears.
Now, I think, you know, in the end, when I went to the governor's ball, the folks at the Academy were just relieved that it had gone through smoothly. You know, the biggest hiccup really for them, as I understand it, was the whole thing with Sacha Baron Cohen on the red carpet.
Okay, yeah.
In the end, maybe they would have been better off telling him not to show up. But I don't see how you do that. I don't see how you forbid. You know, he must have, apparently he promised them that he would behave and then he didn't.
Okay, so he showed up dressed as the dictator.
Which they knew would happen, but he went and dumped ashes on Ryan Seacrest.
The ashes of a supposedly Kim Jong-il. Yeah. I mean, it was a funny little bit, but
and
I think
Rick Robertson of the Academy is literally hovering behind him, looking anxious, and tells a security guard to drag him away.
Yeah, yeah,
that was amazing.
Well, Anne, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. I think we've discussed the Spirit Awards already, so and the artist was the big winner there. And you've had a very long weekend, and we will place links to all of your work in the show notes. And of course, people can always follow you on Twitter. You are at AK Stanwyck. We'll place links to all of that in the show notes.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Fun as always. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it was nice of Anne Thompson to join us. I don't know how she remains so cheerful having to cover all those award shows. I mean, I only watch the Oscars. If I had to go through SAG and BAFTA and the Globes and the Spirit Awards, I'd go crazy.
Well, you know, I have covered the awards in the past for a number of years, and I just kind of got burned out on it. But there, I have to say, there is a camaraderie that builds between yourself and the other journalists you're covering the awards with when you're going from show to show and from event to event. And especially over this weekend, it all kind of builds up to this crescendo of Oscar weekend where you're covering like three or four award ceremonies in the space of 48 to 72 hours. And you really also begin to build up a camaraderie with the publicists that are handling all of the talent and the artists, no pun intended, and you begin to get to know them in a not intimate way, but a more interesting way.
Well, I'm sure the soldiers in Vietnam bonded as well. It doesn't mean I want to go through it.
No, well, I don't necessarily wouldn't cover, you know, compare covering the, you know, award season.
I wasn't comparing. I was making a joke. Move on.
Okay, well, then why don't we move on to, if you didn't like that television show, then maybe you could watch another television show. And I know you have cable, right? Time Warner?
Yep.
Well, if you lived in Kansas City, you may be able to get Google's apparent and rumored cable television offering.
Well, what's the deal? What have they done?
Well, I mean, this is all stemming from some filing that they did. I think it was with the FCC, and they have a subsidiary, Google Fiber, which recently filed for applications in both Missouri and Kansas to operate a video service. And they are laying fiber in Kansas City. So that was their kind of test bed to roll out fiber and test. Now they want to say they want to test IPTV.
So, I mean, in Kansas, they're launching a very high speed internet service.
Yeah, like very high speed. You know,
they're like next generation, two generations ahead. And they've also they're purchasing Motorola Mobility, a company which makes set top boxes, which are the stuff that lets you sort of the gateway for television, whether it's coming through your cable provider or your satellite dish or whatever. And now they're filing an application to try and offer in television over the internet, you know, much like AT&T does with their UVerse offering, which did not do well, of course.
Right. Nor did Verizon's Fios, which was both fiber and, you know.
So they don't have any deals with any content providers.
No,
they don't have any deals with any television stations. This is just very early days where Google, like everybody else, would like to offer you TV and become your, you know, big provider so they can make more money.
Right. I mean, really what they're seeing is that once you put a pipe into the home, you can be a dumb pipe and just pipe any data into the home, or you can actually begin to bundle content together and pump that into the home, and you can make more money by bundling all of this content together. And that's their big problem right now, or not problem, but that's one of the hurdles they'll have to overcome, is they have no content. And so they're going to have to show up with some very deep pockets, and you know, luckily for them, they have deep pockets over there at Google, that they're going to have to go out and get ESPN. They're going to have to go out and get AMC or
well, they can't go out and cherry pick individual channels. That's the problem. They got to do a big deal with a lot of them in order to get a lot of channels. You know, they're not going to be able to just make a deal for one show or one channel. So it's a lot of work. But your cable provider says, hey, we're giving you cable. Why don't we sell you telephone? Your telephone provider says, hey, we've got a pipe selling you your telephone service. Why not let us sell you cable? And then they both say, why don't we get to offer you your Wi-Fi? And now Google's come in with your Wi-Fi, a big new network, and said, hey, they probably want to offer telephone and television as well.
Right. Well, certainly in Kansas City, look, this is all a big, giant experiment for Google. And they have, you know, pockets deep enough to afford these kinds of experiments. Most people don't have billions of dollars to go, hey, let's try something. And we'll see if it works. If it doesn't, you know, we'll get out of it and it's in a limited market. But, you know, as far as, you know, buying just a single channel, they could actually go out and buy just a single channel. However, if they go out and buy a channel from, say, Comcast, Comcast isn't going to sell them just one channel. They're going to say, well, we own Bravo and NBC.
Said.
But there are networks and cable networks where it is just the one channel.
Like what?
You know, some of those like, you know, Spike TV. Well, I don't know.
They're owned by a bigger person too.
Yeah, I mean, there's some like really like limited.
Okay, they're going to be so obscure you can't even name one.
I'm trying to think of the Outdoor Life Channel, OLC, I think it's called, where it's just that one channel and they're not owned by a bigger subsidiary.
I've never heard of the Outdoor Life Channel.
You see, I couldn't even remember the name of it. So,
right. Well, the point is we want more competition. We want multiple people offering you services in your home. This is why it matters. Basically, right now you have your cable providers or your satellite provider offering you television. The phone companies have tried to do it. Now Google's going to try and be a competitor as well.
Yeah, I mean, quite honestly, I think that it boils down to I would like to see more competition in the same market. So here in Los Angeles, you can only go with Time Warner or in certain pockets, you know, Charter Communications. You can't go with Comcast. You can't go with I can't go with Verizon because they're not, you know, they get these monopolies for a territory and then there's no
right,
place else.
Because in the old days, that was the only way that it made sense. You know, that you were having to provide a monopoly because you had to build the whole network in the town. Who was going to build it? Well, you had to pick a company to build it, and therefore they got to sell you your cable. Now you have satellite offering a little competition, and you have the telephone people and now internet people getting new ways into your home, laying new network, and therefore now there can be competition.
Right, but that regulation has not ended. And so, you know, every time they try to break up those territorial monopolies, the cable companies go out crying, oh, you can't do that. We can't afford it. You know, we have to all this infrastructure we have to pay for. Well, that infrastructure was subsidized when it was put in anyway. So it's time to actually. That
all right.
Was 20
years
ago.
This is so pie in the sky. It's far and away. But right now, if you're interested, you can go to outdoorchannel.com and find out where Outdoor Channel is playing in your neighborhood. It's the home of the 12th annual Golden Moose Award.
There you go. You see?
So I'm sure people are flocking.
Yes.
If you like fishing, shooting, or off-road, this is your cable channel.
Well, and it's probably got as many viewers as Oprah Winfrey's network.
Ouch.
Ooh. Well, anyway, so if Google showed up, would you...
That's Oscar winner Oprah Winfrey to you.
That's
or
true.
Or Oscar honoree.
I was going to say, she didn't actually win one. But now, would you go with Google if they showed up in your neighborhood?
It depends on what they're offering.
Okay. So right now you're saying, you know what, until they actually...
I don't want to give Google control over my life either. I don't want to have Google be my Gmail and my Google and my Google phone and my Android phone and my Google television. You know, I don't want to... I like to split everything up.
Well, I think until they actually lay out some real plans here and put something in writing...
Well, we spent 7 minutes talking about it.
Well, I think it's not that big a deal until they do that.
All right. I get it.
Yeah, that's right. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, author J.K. Rowling is back, but Harry Potter is not. The best-selling creator of The Boy Wizard has long talked about writing adult books, and now it's finally happened. Wait, she's going from writing young adult books to porn? I don't get it.
Keep going.
Anyway, Rowling signed a deal with Little Brown, giving the publisher world rights to the unnamed novel in print, ebook, and audio form. When the book will come out and what it's about are all still a mystery. One they'll happily clear up later this year. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. She's one of the best-selling authors of all time. I said it was a mystery because when I interviewed her, she said that one of the type of books she'd like to write is a mystery. She'd written a couple novels before Harry Potter, literary works that she put in a drawer. They were very bad. And I think mystery is a genre that she might want to do. There's a lot of little mysteries in Harry Potter, so it makes a good fit. I'm very excited, but there's two things that make this sort of interesting. One, we've been saying for a while that book sales are going to stop being country by country and just be by language, because it's so easy to make a book available all over the world now, especially ebooks. It doesn't make sense to sell a book rights in the U.S. and Australia and England. They're now going to English language rights, and that's exactly what happened here. She sold the world English rights to this book to Little Brown. She also signed with a major publisher rather than going it alone. There was a lot of worry in the industry that because of her big website, Pottermore, and she was going to make ebook versions of Harry Potter available, that she might become a self-published author. She had that power. She had that ability. She obviously has the name recognition, but she decided it wasn't worth her effort and energy to set up a whole system to sell ebooks to people all over the world. And she decided there's still value in a major publisher. So I know that makes the industry very, very happy.
Well, what does a major publisher require? Not just the novel in print. They require everything, ebook and audio form. Whereas when she signed for Harry Potter and signed all those contracts for Harry Potter, ebooks didn't exist and she retained those rights.
I'm not sure what you're saying there. She could have withheld rights that she wanted to, and many authors do retain certain rights. Like the more popular authors will retain movie rights.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and a lot of times the hardcover and paperback get split up, and so hardcover and ebook can get split up. So I don't think that's an issue. You know.
Well, I think these days when authors are signing, that's been a kind of a bone of contention. They want all the rights. They want the audio rights. And maybe she's big enough. She's probably big enough that she could have turned around and said, I'm giving you print, but I'm not giving you ebook and audio.
Right. Well, exactly. But she decided not to. Yeah. But I mean, there aren't many authors who want to sell the hardcover rights, but keep the ebook rights. They're basically saying either I want to go it alone or I want to work with a publisher. You know, it's not often that they'll say, well, I want the audio rights, but you can have the ebook. You know, that's not happening very much. It's either they go it alone or they go with a publisher.
Well, now, let me ask you this. We've talked a lot about movies during this episode, and I know you go to the movies a lot. When you go to the movies, are you sick of the endless ads that are in movie theaters?
I am, absolutely. I hate it. I hate that they don't. I don't mind if they want to run ads before the movie starts, but run them for the 20 minutes before the start time of the movie. If the movie is supposed to start at 12:05, I would like to sit down at 12:05 and see the trailers and then the movie. I don't want to see 20 minutes of ads.
Well, I'm going to have to say, you know, tough noogies, because people used to complain about all, just like yourself, about the onslaught of ads in a movie theater. They'd boo and they'd whistle whenever one appeared. And movie theater owners just ignored all those complaints. And now the ads are actually, as you know, Michael, a fact of life, delaying the start of a movie, as you just mentioned, sometimes 20 minutes or even a half an hour after the scheduled start time. And it's really only going to continue, because now movie theater ad company National CineMedia is nudging into the upfront TV market, which is the May event where major networks show up and they show top advertisers their fall lineup or their upcoming shows. They're joining Google, Yahoo, AOL, and other companies that are all using the upfront season to pitch their fall shows and their fall plans to advertisers. Which would you advertise on, Michael? Some new drama called Awake or The Amazing Spider-Man? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal how that sort of the cycle of television advertising is taking over every part of the advertising world. Everybody sort of thinks in the sense, all right, let's meet together two or three times a year and tell them what we're planning and get them to commit to all our properties. You know, everybody plans 6 months, a year ahead. We know what movies are coming out next summer, even next fall to a degree. So the cycle of looking long term and planning well ahead is coming even to movie advertising. It's kind of interesting.
The Gannett newspaper chain is adding paywalls to 80 markets where it owns local newspapers. And oh, by the way, so is the Los Angeles Times starting March 5th. You'll have to pay, I think 99 cents a week for the first 4 weeks. Anyway, it's the same thing that the New York Times has done. They'll limit non-subscribers to a certain number of articles each month before blocking them out. This does not apply to Gannett's national newspaper, USA Today, which is surely the most significant paper in their chain. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. The New York Times started it, and I think it's only a matter of months before every paper in the country is essentially doing the same thing. You're going to have be a subscriber to get access to all this information that they're paying good money to provide.
The X Factor is gaining legitimacy the same way American Idol did by launching the careers of singers and performers. The first season of The X Factor crowned Melody Amaro. Is that how? Amaro?
Amaro.
Amaro. Well, she was the winner, and she's got a record deal, of course, and is in the Whitney Houston, Mariah Carey vein of pop star and pop singing. Chris Renee and Marcus Chanti and the Joe Cocker wannabe Josh Kratchik also have deals. But two acts that never really reached the finals are creating the most buzz in the industry. First, there's 15-year-old Astro, who signed a record deal with Epic Records, the home of L.A. Reid, who is one of the show's judges. And now, last week, pint-sized singer and bubbly 14-year-old Rachel Crowe has scored one as well. She toyed with Disney initially, but has now inked several deals. Sony will be her musical home, and Nickelodeon will be her acting home. Crowe immediately lands a recurring role on the new TV series Fred, as well as having the network develop a show built around her for the future. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. You know, last season, American Idol, I think like 8 or 9 of the top 10 performers got deals, but they haven't really made many waves yet. There's a lot of talent, I think, that was in that first season of The X Factor. And if these people break out at all, that's really going to help the show. I think people will say, oh, wow, this show launched some stars. And that's going to help them second season and third season and down the road. It's exactly what happened with Idol.
Are Hulu and Netflix feeling the heat? Comcast has just launched a new subscription VOD service for existing video subscribers. It's called Xfinity Stream Picks and allows users to access vintage TV and movies via their TV, mobile devices, and the web. Content providers include Disney ABC, NBC Universal, Sony, and Warner Brothers. There's no info on the amount of hours available, but shows on offer include 30 Rock, Grey's Anatomy, Heroes, Married with Children, and movies like Brokeback Mountain and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's offered for free to Comcast Triple Play subscribers. So, Michael, there's that thing where, you know, it's phone, cable, and internet. And, you know, it's offered with other bundles as well. It is also available for $5 per month to basic subscribers and is the latest step towards TV Anywhere. The new library of programming will be added to the 75,000 TV shows and movies already available via Xfinity. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
So a cable company is making a library of stuff available to their subscribers.
Pretty much, yes.
Mm-hmm. It's a big deal in the sense that everybody's doing it now. I just think I don't like exclusive deals. I want everybody offering it and make it all essentially the same. And then, you know, you have to worry about, oh, if I want this show, I have to subscribe to this one. Or if I want that show, I got to go there. You know, the more people that offer a big, broad service like this, the better it is for everybody.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you in regards to you know, all of this exclusivity business. You know, certainly some exclusivity is, you know, like Lilyhammer with Netflix is only airing on Netflix. You know, I get that. That's their original programming and they want to keep that to themselves.
But when duh.
Yeah, but when you're striking deals with production companies and studios, it doesn't make sense to have a studio go to just one. I'm sure to the studios and I'm sure to the business model it makes sense, but to consumers, it's a pain in the neck. The Grammys set records in the ratings, and now the artists featured on the show are setting records on the charts. Katy Perry performed on the show, and her new single, Part of Me, debuts at number one, making her the first artist in the history of Capitol Records to do so. Nicki Minaj, who got pilloried by critics for her performance on the Grammys, but her new single, Starships, debuts at number seven. Whitney Houston's tribute sees her with three songs in the top 40, and I Will Always Love You, rising to number three, that's her big hit. But Adele continues to be the real force in music. She now has 3 songs in the top 10, the first female artist in history to actually have that happen. Plus, her album, 21, sold a record-setting 730,000 copies the week after winning Album of the Year, more than any other Best Album winner in history. And finally, 21 is back at number 1 for a rather appropriate 21 weeks. And that passes Whitney Houston's The Bodyguard to make it the female-powered album with the most weeks at number 1 in chart history. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It means albums can still sell. I mean, this is obviously a big phenomenon with every planet aligning to make this happen. And she's still only at like 6-7 million copies in North America. It should be 10 or 15 at this point. But, you know, you're on TV. TV can still be a force. People will still go out and buy albums. It's good news for the industry.
Yeah, I mean, when you're advertising to 40 million people, yeah, that's a pretty good marketing campaign. Best-selling children's author Jean Craighead George has publicly joined the defendants in a lawsuit over the ebook publication of her classic bestseller, Julie of the Wolves. Her ebook publisher, Open Road, is being sued by her print publisher, HarperCollins, which says it alone holds the right to print an ebook version of her novel. George said, and this is a quote, "I have asked to intervene in this action to protect my rights under copyright and under my original contract with HarperCollins. When I signed that contract in 1971, ebooks did not exist, so I could not have granted those rights. I am with Open Road all the way." Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. This looks like a classic case for the courts to make a judgment here. Almost every contract in like creative content involves some phrase like, you know, we are going to buy the rights for every format now known or hereafter invented.
That's right. Yeah, they call that the future media clause. Yeah.
Future media clause, which is just malarkey, really. It's sort of boilerplate, but it's also malarkey and it needs to be tested in the courts. And Gene is saying pretty reasonably, look, you know, this was not even remotely on anyone's horizon. And it's like saying before paperbacks were invented, you could have sold away your paperback rights. Well, if they didn't exist, you know, it doesn't work. And so, you know, it's boilerplate contract. It needs to be a good test case. It's going to the courts. It's a classic example. It was signed so long before ebooks that it's clear that you have to decide what does this phrase in the contract actually mean and what rights does it grant to the people involved. And I think it's a great test case and I can't wait to find out what happens.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because, you know, usually filmmakers, they've sold the rights away to the copyright to the movie. So that whole future media or some call it a future technology clause, it really has not mattered at all because, they don't really own any part of the film anyway, whereas authors do own 100%.
Right.
Yeah, so that whole clause is going to be fought by, of all people, authors. I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's like, well, if you sell the right to a book and they turn it into a movie, and it's in the 1940s, and then 30 years later, the filmmakers try to turn it into a video game, and the author says, well, wait a second, I didn't sell the rights to a video game.
That's right.
You know, it's just a very different thing, so it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Coco isn't going anywhere. TBS announced Conan O'Brien's talk show has just been renewed for 2 more years through 2014. Now, George Lopez was reaching 900,000 viewers a night in that same time slot, and Conan has increased that about 23% to 1.1 million viewers a night. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal, I guess. It keeps him, he must be making them money or they wouldn't keep him on the air. And, you know, it looks good for the network. It's just a very, very crowded late night.
Yeah, I in a way, I see this as a big whoop. He was definitely going to be renewed because what else is, you know, TBS going to do? And he took a huge shot on them by actually agreeing to go from network TV to cable. So,
well, he didn't take a huge leap on them. He was out of job.
Well, true.
They bumped George Lopez, who was doing quite well. And in fact, they owned the George Lopez show. I'm still not convinced that they wouldn't be making more money if they had kept George Lopez in place.
When Paramount bought the rights to Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather, they also gained control over any literary sequels. This story should have followed our previous ebook story. They and the estate have been battling ever since over monies due from the film, from VHS and DVD, from video games, and now over the books. The estate worked with Paramount on an official sequel via Random House titled The Godfather Returns in 2004, and that was released via Random House. Then Paramount alleges the family went ahead on its own and without permission published another sequel, The Godfather's Revenge, in 2006. Now they're planning yet another spinoff, and Paramount is suing to stop the tarnishing of its franchise. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, but it's pretty fascinating. They turned a book into a movie That's one of the most acclaimed films of all time. And they're saying, if you do another sequel to the book, you're going to hurt our movie's image. The idea that they even have the rights to control this is fascinating, but it is in their contract. It's very specific. And why they didn't act in 2006 when that last book was released, you know, as they say, against the rights that they owned, I don't understand. But now they're saying, we hear there's another book coming out. We're really going to drop the hammer now. I'm sure it's going to hurt them in court that they didn't act more strongly in 2006. But I think it's hilarious. You know, usually movies are always considered the redheaded stepchild to books. And to think that a movie could be damaged by having a book come out is kind of interesting.
Barbra Streisand is about to celebrate her 50th anniversary at Columbia Records. It could have been...
Memories! Sorry.
and my jokes are bad. It could have been a goodbye party since her contract was up and Streisand wanted to make certain she got a deal worthy of her value to the label. Apparently, that happened because the chairman of Columbia announced the deal by saying, and this is a quote, "There are stars, there are superstars, and then there is Barbra Streisand." No word on what the deal entails, though the chance to repackage her catalog is enticing, and plans include a massive 12-DVD set. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It was hard to imagine her going anywhere else. But, you know, the article in Hollywood Reporter said that only Tony Bennett had been with a record label longer, or Columbia longer. But it's not true. Bob Dylan has been at Columbia Records even longer than Streisand, which is kind of weird to think about because he always seems a little bit more contemporary than Barbra, though they've obviously both been around for many years, you know, 50 years now. But his first album on Columbia came out in 62. Hers came out in 63, 1 year later, almost, you know, to the month. You know, 12 DVDs? What in heaven's name is going to be on that? I don't know.
I know. I
was in the theater and two men behind me were talking excitedly about it. So there's somebody waiting to buy it.
Okay.
But of course, that's the audience in a Broadway musical theater house.
What are you saying, Michael?
I'm saying they like Barbra Streisand.
Okay. Yeah, well, Barbra Streisand did get her start on Broadway. That's where I was headed with that. The Concert Biz Titan Live Nation released its earnings last week, and it was the earnings for all of 2011. And despite a global recession, Live Nation actually managed to improve over 2010. It's still losing money, mind you, but not as much money as they lost in 2010, and revenue is actually up. They can thank strong tours by the likes of Jimmy Buffett and Roger Waters, Van Halen, and the like. Festivals are also proving a strong draw, with many events like Coachella sold out long before they even happen. Upcoming tours by Springsteen, Dave Matthews, and Madonna, who, by the way, is selling $300 tickets with ease, make 2012 look even sunnier, brighter, better. I don't know. You tell me, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. We're not losing as much money as we did last year. Not exactly the most rousing call to arms.
No, not at all. Although $300 tickets, I mean, don't get me... I couldn't even get tickets to Springsteen, so I don't even want to talk about it. Is the MPAA a big bully? That's how the Weinstein Company feels. They submitted a documentary about bullying that includes some harsh language from its bully subjects and pleaded for a PG-13 rating so that the movie could easily be shown in high schools to the very group, and that group being teenagers, the movie was intended to reach. They even brought in kids who had been bullied to argue for the film. But the MPAA said the language in the film made for an R rating, as that was necessary. In response, the Weinstein Company released a statement saying it is, quote, considering a leave of absence from the MPAA, end quote. The only problem with this threat is that the Weinstein Company doesn't actually belong to the Motion Picture Association of America. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. We're going to leave. And they don't really belong.
Really? We didn't even know you were here. So
yeah, many small companies do not belong to the MPAA. All the major studios do, but the indie companies like Weinstein often do not belong. So it's not unusual. It's funny that they would threaten to leave. However, I have not seen the film Bully, but just based on the description, it sounds like another ridiculous failure on the ratings people to put a film in context. You know, their predilection to despise sex over violence is well known. And in this case, a movie made to reach out to teens to talk about bullying. There were high schools lined up ready to screen the film for their students, and they can't do it now because it's an R rating. And I can't imagine that in context, it isn't an appropriate rating to say PG-13. It just, it doesn't make any sense. It's another head scratcher where you go, what were they thinking?
Yeah, and I know that, you go talk to the MPAA about this, and they say, look, we get, 600 movies a year we put ratings on, and there's, 10 that
always have one or two people complain about.
Yeah, but, they're usually one or two ridiculous instances. And quite frankly, there are those that should be rated R that aren't.
Yeah,
Yeah. You know, where, you know, Transformers is a violence. very violent movie, but it's cartoon violent, so it's okay, so it's PG-13. Although, you know, you talk about a breast or the word sex, and all of a sudden you're rated R. So
yeah, I mean, it's hard to, you know, you've got a country with 330 million people or whatever, 320 million people. You're never going to reflect the taste of everybody. What one person's R is another person's PG-13. It's an almost Sisyphean task, and yet they can do a better job.
Well, that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, some of these stories really do affect our listeners because they're all about how Hollywood is, as the New York Times put it, aflutter over streaming video deals. I mean, all of these studios and all of these production companies that have this content have the likes of Netflix and Verizon and Google and Amazon and Hulu Plus and YouTube and some folks overseas. They're all knocking at their doors now saying, we need content. How much for your content?
Well, Hollywood's excited because for the first time, they're ahead of the technology curve a little bit rather than desperately behind.
That's
normally
right.
What happens is something new comes up like videotape and they freak out. They're like, oh my God, VHS tapes are going to destroy the industry. And they yell and scream and they fight it until they realize they're going to make a lot more money. Or cable comes along and they're scared by that, or video on demand, or pay-per-view, or DVDs, or streaming. And they've always been freaked out and scared every step of the way. They always think new technology is going to destroy the business. Then what happens is they make money from it and they relax.
That's
and
right.
Now it looks like they're a little bit smarter about video on demand and streaming, where they're saying, okay, they're making deals, they're making really good money, and they're thinking, oh, hey, here's our savior. It's going to make up for the falling in DVD sales. It's going to provide a big new revenue stream. We're so excited. We're not idiots.
Well, you know, actually, I cannot agree with you more. And in 1996, 1997, I spent a year trying to convince, I was working at a creative artist agency at the time, a year trying to convince some of the agents there who were in the tech, you know, world. They were, you know, agents who dealt with tech companies to bring in some of the folks behind this new technology called the digital video disc and a DVD. They didn't want to hear anything about it.
How could they not, knowing the success of VHS at that point? How could they, what possible fear could they have? Well, I think at the time they were worried it was too good of a copy.
Well, in part, that was it. In part, they basically looked at it and said, how much are these players? $1,000? You know, give me a break. You know, look, laser discs didn't take off, okay? So yes, it's nice that this shiny disc is around, but we don't see this happening. Well, of course, by 1999, DVDs had supplanted VHS. And
the quote from the New York Times is good, where the industry's a little bit proud of themselves. Peter Guber, who was a former head of Columbia Pictures, has a quote where he talks about how Hollywood, instead of being freaked out about how people are watching movies on their phones and digital streaming, it's scaring them, how they're kind of excited. He says, quote, the mood has shifted from, oh my God, our business models are broken and we're going to be cannibalized, to something resembling euphoria, said Peter Guber, a former chairman of Columbia Pictures, who is now chief executive of the Mandalay Entertainment Group, which has interest in movies, TV, and sports. Studios see a robust, accelerating online market.
That's what he says, yeah.
And what are some of the deals that they're talking about?
Well, Netflix is spending about $1.8 billion on content in this year alone. Verizon and Redbox have teamed up, which we've talked about in the past, and they have a competing service. Google, as we just mentioned, is developing a home entertainment device, and you have that Comcast deal with Xfinity. Amazon added Viacom to its streaming library for Amazon Prime and the Kindle Fire, so it also plans to launch a standalone streaming service at some point. That's kind of a rumor. Hulu Plus continues to grow, and YouTube and Google are, you know, expanding their streaming services, along with, you know, Vudu's over at Walmart, Best Buy has Cinema Now, and then there's always iTunes. Think about all of those people coming and knocking at your door. You can start a nice little bidding war.
And that's just in North America.
That's right, overseas players are popping up, like Netmovies, say, in Brazil.
Right, so they're going to be able to sell these deals. Every country wants to have Hollywood movies and TV shows to show to their people in every country via this service. So your library just became very valuable.
That's right, yeah. I mean, and let's face it, competition is actually a good thing. We talked about it when it comes to cable. We want more competition. And I think that competition for these, not only our attention as moviegoers and as consumers of this content, but the competition to get that content from studios, it's got to be good.
Yeah, one thing studios have to remember is that they're not going to see the massive bubble in sales that you got with first VHS and really DVD and Blu-ray. That's where when people suddenly started buying CDs, they replaced all their LPs because CDs were so much better. They bought their whole library of music all over again. Same thing happened with DVDs and Blu-ray. It was so much better than the VHS tape. People happily repurchased movies they already owned because the DVD was superior. Now, that's just not going to happen on digital. First of all, there's no real advantage to digital over DVD and Blu-ray. Plus, a lot of DVD and Blu-ray already offer digital copies, especially nowadays. So there's not going to be that, you know, that bubble, that short-term bump where people rebuy their library. That's just not going to happen. And whatever sales they get right now as people are competing with each other, I imagine it's going to settle down. I think Netflix probably overpaid that $1.8 billion. It just seems too high. How can they keep paying that much money? And I think once you've got more people, there'll be more competitors, but I think prices will get a little bit more reasonable. If you've got five people paying you, you know, $500 million, that's better than one person paying you $1 billion. So, you know, prices, I think, will sort of stabilize, become a little more reasonable. So, you know, that's something
I would agree with that. I think that I've always said $1.8 billion is way too much money for Netflix to be spending on that content, but they're getting it exclusively and they're getting it first. And so what they're trying to do is lock in all of their customers. So you go and you subscribe to Netflix and you're locked in. You don't switch from, you know, a mobile phone provider to another that often. And likewise, they're thinking the same thing is true. But the reality is switching from Netflix to Hulu Plus is not that hard. It's not that difficult. Yes, you lose your queue. Yes, you lose some content that you may or may not have, you know, saved or tagged as a favorite, and you lose all of that. But it's not that hard. You just stop one subscription and start another.
And I'm very encouraging of people to recognize DVD and Blu-ray and video on demand and multiple platforms. You should make your cable channels available on an iPad, and it shouldn't just be in your home. You should be able to access it anywhere. I like innovation. I like all these ideas. But I do think you don't want to be too cavalier about trashing some of the bulwark of your system. And we had a guy a couple of weeks ago who was talking about how they should just, don't worry about Windows. Get rid of your movie windows. Show movies in the home right away, the week in the open. So what if the movie theater doesn't make money? You'll still make money.
Who was saying that?
Remember, we had a quote from the guy who was talking about how...
Oh, that was Richard Greenfield. Oh, yes. Okay. That was. Right. I thought you said we had a guest on the show that was saying that.
No, not a guest. A guy that we were talking about. And I think it's really important to remember how important the movie theater chains are and the showcasing they do for movies and how that makes movies so much more viable all the way down the road. It doesn't mean windows won't tighten. It doesn't mean you shouldn't make movies available in other ways. It doesn't mean a small indie film that would never open in more than 50 screens is very different from, you know, the next amazing Spider-Man. But you cannot undersell the importance of having movies open in every town in the country with billboards and advertising and movie reviews and TV commercials. The name value and recognition that gives to a movie is huge. And if you look at the record industry and the, what was the other one? The book publishers, when you can see what happens to them when they lose that showcase, when there are not record stores in every city in the country anymore, and there aren't, and when bookstores start disappearing and suddenly people don't have a store to walk into to see what new books are out, it's very hard to replace that. And, you know, video on demand does not do that. So be very careful about trashing that massive system you have of, you know, 20,000 screens or whatever in North America that can showcase your movies in every town in the country.
Actually, it's 40,000 screens in
North America. 40,000, there you go.
Yeah, so, no, and I think I would agree with you. Look, the reason that, you know, the Oscars are the Oscars and the Emmys are the Emmys and they're nice, but they're not the Oscars is because, you know, people look at being a movie star as being, you know, it's an exclusivity that not everybody gets a chance to be on a movie screen that's 50 feet wide and, you know, 10, 20 feet tall. I'm totally agreeing with everything you're saying.
So what does this mean for our listeners? I think it means that pretty soon they're going to be able to access their cable, whatever their TV provider is, be it a cable company or satellite or Google, they're going to be able to access any TV show that they pay for, I think, on a tablet, and I don't think they'll have to be in their home. On a tablet, on a phone, in their home, you know, when they're on the road via their laptop, I think they'll get that access to almost everything that they pay for.
That's right. And I think that is that goal or that dream of having any film available to you with the click of a button is actually coming true. It's taken a long time, but it's actually coming true.
I think you're right. What else is coming true?
You know what's coming true is that our show is going to wrap up and end. I know we've talked your ear off for over an hour now at this point. So we should probably wrap up and tell you where you can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in Stitcher or in your RSS reader or your favorite podcatcher. And we really urge you to go to, you know, iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or any of these podcast directories and rate and review our show. It really does help us out there. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as links to all of Ann Thompson's work. She's over at IndieWire. We'll place those in the show notes, which can be found on showbizsandbox.com. Now, our website, showbizsandbox.com, as I just mentioned, is also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can even leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And we are on Twitter and Facebook. On Twitter, we're at Showbiz Sandbox. And on Facebook, if you go and search for Showbiz Sandbox, you'll find our page there. We urge you to like us. We just want to be liked. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. Michael, where can we find you?
Remarkably, it's called michaelgiltz.com.
So all of your writing can be found there. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.